the argument in the final argued matter on today's calendar, Reinecker v. Sumac Textile Company, Limited, case number 242090. Mr. Weingarten. You can lower that. Yep. There you go.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Noah Weingarten. We represent Ryan Reinecker, the litigation administrator of the post-confirmation estates of Decor Holdings, Inc. et al. We're here today on appeal to seek reinstatement of the bankruptcy court's initial judgment that was entered in favor of the litigation administrator and against defendant Sumac Textile Company, Limited, by default. And we are seeking the reversal of the district court's reversal and remand of the bankruptcy court's judgment for several reasons. And before I get into the merits, I just want to point out the sole issue here is whether there was sufficient service of process. That's the key issue. And it's whether there was sufficient service to establish personal jurisdiction over Sumac at the time that the bankruptcy court entered the initial judgment. We submit that the answer should be yes, there was sufficient service. And what I want to do is point out that the standard here is fairly deferential to the bankruptcy court. The United States Supreme Court in Espinoza held that in order to avoid a judgment under Federal Rule 60b-4, which is one of the rules that my colleague relied upon, that requires exceptional circumstances, and that a judgment should only be void when the court that rendered judgment lacked, quote, even an arguable basis for jurisdiction, end quote. There isn't just an arguable basis for jurisdiction here, there is jurisdiction here. And so all that we have to find is that there is arguable jurisdiction and the initial judgment should be reinstated. That's our position. It's important when you're in looking at this analysis to see what did the litigation administrator see at the time that service of process was effectuated. There was a proof of claim submitted under penalty of perjury that listed Sumac as the creditor. It was signed by a lawyer. His name was Don Leviton. The proof of claim attached several documents. It attached a collection trust deed that vested authority to collect on Sumac's debt from Sumac to its agent, Sinosure. And then there's another document that called the trust deed and letter of direction, which vested authority from the agent, Sinosure, in B&J. And so those documents put together gave B&J the authority to file the proof of claim on Sumac's behalf. And because the proof of claim was authorized, it means that the litigation administrator had the authority to serve the summons and complaint at the notice.
Where is the authority for that under the bankruptcy rules?
For which point, Your Honor?
For the proposition, as I understand it, you're making, that merely by being an agent for purposes of filing a proof of claim, you're also authorized to receive service of process in an adversary proceeding. Where's the language to which you point for that, or the authority?
So there's two pieces to that, Your Honor. The first piece is that B&J, by virtue of being authorized to collect the debt, it had to file a proof of claim because it was necessary and incidental to its authority. And for that point, we cite the several cases in our papers. We cite the CBS v. Stokely Van Camp and the Village of Island Park case. And we also cited
the fact that it had to do anything doesn't answer my question,
sure.
Which is why is that by itself? Where is the authority for concluding that that by itself is enough to demonstrate that it's also authorized to receive service of process in an adversary proceeding?
So the authority, Your Honor, there's a well-established line of cases called takeout. Takeout was a case, it's not in the bankruptcy code or the bankruptcy rules, it's really case law that establishes that the noticing agent listed in the proof of claim is authorized to receive service of process. And so for that, we cite to the takeout case, we cite to In Re Mis Interpret, and we cite to another case called Outlet. And I can give you, Your Honor, the cites in our brief. That we cited that extensively in our opening brief at pages 40 through 43. And those cases, they expressly, in takeout, the court said that an agent listed as the noticing agent on a proof of claim means that the agent is, quote, explicitly appointed as the creditor's authorized agent for service of process, end quote. And so as a result of B&J having the authority to file the claim, it was then authorized to accept service of process on Sumec's behalf. The bankruptcy court correctly concluded that those two documents that were appended to the proof of claim, they were the manifest authorization or the manifestation of authorization from Sumec to file the proof of claim and to collect the debt. Now, the district court on appeal of the bankruptcy court, it concluded that there was no actual authority and that there was no apparent authority. And we submit that that was error and that B&J, in fact, had both forms of authority. On the actual authority point, B&J had that actual authority for two reasons. First, as I just said, there was a direct manifestation from Sumec to Sinosure and then Sinosure to B&J. The second thing, as I just alluded to with Your Honor, with Judge Lohier, is that filing the proof of claim was necessary and incidental to collecting on the debt. We cited cases in our opening brief that found that, you know, collecting on a debt, there is no other way to collect on a debt against a bankruptcy debtor other than by filing a proof of claim. If you do not file a proof of claim, then there's no other way to collect it because you'd be in violation of the bankruptcy automatic stay under 11 U.S.C. 362.
So there is a difference between suing and being sued.
Yes, Your Honor, that is true. And so Sumec, the proof of claim that was submitted in Sumec's name, which I know my colleague would challenge, and it was authorized, that it submits you to the personal jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court when you do submit a proof of claim. We cite to the Hong Kong case, the Hong Kong Savings Bank case, that says when you submit a proof of claim, that means that you're now subject to the personal jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court. And so there are cases, the takeout case is very helpful in that regard. Because there, what happened, it's a case that's on nearly all fours with this case.
Are there any cases above the bankruptcy or district court level that say that?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, Your Honor.
Are there any cases above the district court level and the bankruptcy court level that say that? Takeout's a bankruptcy case.
Yes, Your Honor. We have been unable to find a case that says that. And that's one of the reasons why we think it's important for this court to provide a clear precedent on that point. We think that this case, it's a bankruptcy appeal, but a decision by this court is important and would have broad-ranging ramifications beyond just the two parties here. There are several policy reasons I wanted to focus the court on for why there needs to be a correction here, respectfully, of the district court. The first is that, as Your Honor just alluded to, there is no circuit-level decision in this circuit that affirms what the other courts have said repeatedly, that by filing a proof of claim, the noticing agent is authorized to accept service of process. That is something that's just a...
Are there any exceptions in your view to this rule? Because that's a very broad rule. So as soon as an authorized agent files a proof of claim, that automatically, without exception, I think is what you're saying, means that the same agent is authorized or has got to accept a service of process as an agent for that purpose. Is there an exception to that? Because, you know, the district court talked about attorney, non-attorney, and so on, but are there exceptions that you'd be prepared to acknowledge?
I would be. I just can't think of them at the moment. The issue is that the district court did create exceptions to that rule. We just disagree with them because we believe that they're inconsistent with Rule 7004, the service statute, which allows for service on non-lawyers, such as agents and whatnot. And so by limiting the agent in the noticing...
So, for example, and I don't know enough about proofs of claim, thankfully, perhaps, but... can an agent, and we've got the proof of claim here in the record, but can an agent or whoever who files a proof of claim say this is filed and it is limited? My agency or our agency is limited for purposes of just filing this proof of claim and for no other purpose. Can you say that?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe you could say that. The only caveat is that that would not immunize the creditor who filed the proof of claim from the personal jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court, which I recognize is a different issue.
It's a different case, but you could say that just to, for example, protect your, for the principal to protect itself from service of process to that agent. Is that fair?
Okay. That's a very fair exception. And I just want to point out one thing, which is in the record, we do have statements by Sumac who did acknowledge that they knew that Sinosure was going to file a proof of claim.
Yeah.
And they did. Sumac did nothing to do what you just said, Your Honor, which is to carve out.
I understand. So the second question I've got relates to, I think, the district court's decision with respect to setting aside the entry of default for good cause on the ground that Sumac's action was not willful. What is your, just very briefly, what's your position as to that? Because you mentioned we should vacate the bankruptcy court decision. What should we do with respect to the district court decision?
So the district court, well, you should vacate the district court's position, but on the willful point that you're asking me about, we think that it was willful. The sub-agent is a person, so we serve the complaint on the actual person, Mr. Leviton, who is a lawyer. That then is imputed. He's a sub-agent of Sumac. So you have to accept our position that if that BHA was in fact the sub-agent they were, it is absolutely a willful default.
Was there any evidence that they even, that Sumac was even notified or was even aware of the adversary proceeding?
So there is many emails in the record between the litigation administrator's counsel and Peter Gelbis.
Who is not with Sumac, he's with BHA, correct?
That's correct, except there are numerous examples in the record where he says things like, I am in touch with Sumac. Sumac has asked that I reach out and clarify if there is a settlement offer.
Yeah.
And so we had no reason to think otherwise when we had served the complaints and when we were litigating with Sumac. At the time, all we had was this proof of claim.
I mean, usually when we have a district court that says, that determines a willfulness issue, that's very hard to undo. But okay, thank you. You reserve some time for rebuttal, so
sure.
You can rebut me then. Mr. Rosner.
Good morning, Your Honors. For the record, Fred Rosner, the Rosner Law Group, for the FLE Sumac Textile Company. The district court correctly found that Sumac was denied its right to due process to defend against the litigation administrator's complaint. Sumac was a known creditor. Appellant knew Sumac's proper service address in China. Appellant also had valid email addresses for Sumac representatives in China, but appellant at no point made any attempt to serve or even provide fair notice of the lawsuit against Sumac in China. The district court correctly found that Sumac never communicated with either B&J or appellant before entry of the default judgment. That finding is supported by the sworn declaration of Yan Du, who's a senior manager at Sumac. And also there's an email exchange between Mr. Yeldis, who was introduced in appellant's opening remarks, to Yan Du, and this is well after entry of the default judgment, where Mr. Yu says to Mr. Yeldis, Sumac has never been served with any legal document.
So, Mr. Rosner, I appreciate the argument very much, but I think you would agree that we recognize the concept of sub-agency. The idea here, as I understand it, is that B&J is a sub-agent of Sumac through Sanshur. So could you address that?
Yes, I would push back against that. The only document...
So you've got 8 minutes to rebut that. Okay.
The only document that Sumac signed in this case was the collection trust deed. So the issue before the court is whether in that trust deed, Sumac appointed Sinosur, its insurer, to accept service process for Sumac. And the answer must be no, because the district court found that for such types of agencies, the appointment must be expressed. Sumac never communicated with B&J, ever. There was no manifestation of conduct between Sumac and B&J. It was not acting as its sub-agent, and it set forth more clearly.
Let me go back to your first point, because now you're raising a question as to Sinosur's, am I pronouncing that correctly? Sinosur's agency relationship with Sumac and the scope of that agency relationship. Have I understood that? Is that what you're doing?
Yes, it was just to collect a debt. And in the Gu Declaration.
Full power, we grant you full power and give you any assistance you may reasonably require of us in the exercise of such rights and remedies in our or your name. That's the one of the agreements. There's another agreement that gives Sinosur the authority to file the claim.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
Yes, subject to an explanation.
Okay.
As made clear in the new declaration, Sumac never sought to collect a claim for the bankruptcy estate. It had the benefit of insurance. It was not seeking a double recovery. It just wanted its insurance claim paid by Sinosur. Now, in connection with that, Sumac did have an understanding that Sinosur, as insurer, had the right to mitigate whatever payment it made on the insurance to Sumac. And that is the connection between Sinosur and B&J. Sinosur is hiring B&J without Sumac's knowledge. We did not know about the contents of the proof of claim, how it was filled out.
The collection trust deed says it's an agreement and authorization to Sinosur of the full rights for collection on Sumac's behalf against the debtors.
Yeah, that's a translated document. Mr. Gu,
well, all I've got is the English translation, sir. So,
well,
I just did I read that correctly?
I'm sure you did.
Okay.
So, just to answer your question, regardless, if Sumac convey that authority to Sinosur, its insurer. Sinosur did not convey that to B&J. Sinosur did not grant B&J the right to use Sumac's name in seeking collection of the debt. So if I were looking at the proof of claim and the attachments to determine B&J's power and authority, the first thing that I would observe is that B&J signed the proof of claim as legal counsel, Mr. Leviton signed the proof of claim as legal counsel to B&J, not legal counsel to Sumac. And that conflicts with the certificate of service filed by the plan administrator's attorneys with the bankruptcy court, who claim they served it on Don Leviton, defendant's counsel. So there's a disconnect there between what they're looking at and what they're representing to the bankruptcy.
Once Sinosure paid the claim, or paid most of it, it was segregated to the rights of CIMAC. So when it acted to collect in the bankruptcy court, it was standing in the shoes of CIMAC, correct?
That's correct.
So they could act for CIMAC. In fact, the terms of the insurance contract would say that the insurance company can, once it pays a claim, act on behalf of CIMAC. And then it appointed B&J to appear for Sinosure, representing the interests of CIMAC, or rather, standing to collect them on behalf of CIMAC, correct?
Incorrect. Let me explain why. In these subrogation arrangements, the insurer has the right to use the insured's name to avoid a books and records objection from the litigation administrator. I've never heard of Sinosure before, but you get to use the name of the insured to collect. That does not mean they're collecting for CIMAC's economic benefit, which would make no sense because they paid them the insurance.
Oh, no, they are collecting for its economic benefit. The insurance company has already provided the economic benefit to CIMAC, and now it's appearing in the shoes of CIMAC to collect money that would be owed to CIMAC.
After the insurance, I don't think CIMAC would have any...
Well, if you're standing in somebody else's shoes,
well,
and somebody owes them money, then you're—I don't know how to explain it the other way. You're in their shoes. That's a very intimate relationship.
They have the contractual right.
Yes.
Their name, but that doesn't mean the money is going to come. CIMAC's not going to get double recovery.
That's correct.
Right. So they have the right, and regardless, even if they had the right, let's assume arguendo, you know, these are debated. That does not equate to being empowered to accept service of process for CIMAC. That is not the standard I'm asking this court to adopt. That would be a very dangerous precedent for a number of reasons.
Well, surely the question is not yes or no, is it true or not? The question is whether the court had arguable jurisdiction, where, you know, you can argue it, but the more you argue it, you may be arguing that it's arguable.
Yeah. You have to establish personal jurisdiction through Rule 4. Rule 4 is unique. It governs initiation of a complaint and you're suing somebody. So in the bankruptcy code, the way to serve is fairly lenient. You have the benefit of nationwide service of complaints, but it has to be addressed in a very particular way. So if we accepted the concept that by filing a proof of claim, you're accepting service of process, that would render superfluous the Hague Convention. If you want to get personal jurisdiction over foreign creditors all over the world, just set a bar date. They filed proof of claim, got them. I suggest that Rule 4 requires more diligence, and it's proof of claim. The case law says that in the form it says, where should notices be sent? Well, an adversary proceeding is not a notice. It seeks affirmative recovery. Here's $700,000 from somebody. It's not a notice.
So what are the policy reasons that you might want to embrace the rule that your friend on the other side has asked us to embrace, is efficiency, administrative ease, particularly in bankruptcy cases where things need to move, as I understand it, quite quickly. Why is that rule inconsistent with this policy advantage in the bankruptcy context?
There is that concept in Rule 5. Rule 4 governs the initiation of a complaint. Rule 5 expressly allows service at a creditor's last known address, which would be the proof of claim. So that's okay, except for a Rule 4 plea. The other, so It also reduces Rule 4 to an estoppel argument, which is some of the cases brought that concept out, that you put in the proof of claim, you're bound by it. That lowers the burden substantially of what's in Rule 4 now, that you cannot, like in this case, the proof of claim, the address was a P.O. box. You can't serve a complaint at a P.O. box. So it will reduce the due process qualities that are inherent.
Well, no, if this, so in the same way, and I'm just going to ask you about, but in the same way that I asked Mr. your friend on the other side, there might be exceptions, right? So what you're pointing out is an exception to the rule that we're being asked to embrace. So if there's a P.O. box, maybe that's an impediment to service. There may be other impediments or reasons why we would not say that someone, just by virtue of the fact that they filed a proof of claim, that an agent is thereby also opening itself up or its client up or its principal up to service a process. But
I don't think there would be exceptions. In the context, Grand Financiera, Langenthal for Supreme Court cases, that right to jury trial cases. So if I was suing somebody for breach of contract for $1 million and I have a Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial and that entity filed for bankruptcy and I wanted to collect on my $1 million, I would have to file a proof of claim under compulsion of court order. The Supreme Court of the United States says that has legal consequences. By doing that, you've submitted yourself to the equitable jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court for the claims allowance, disallowance process. No more right to jury trial. So if you take that concept, and people file, I file proofs of claim all the time with disclaimers in it, by filing this proof of claim, you lose because the Supreme Court's already ruled on it. So a legal right.
Even a disclaimer as to your authorization as a subagent or an agent to receive service of process in the context of an adversary proceeding. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think there's a case that's ruled on that.
Well, that's this case, so.
Well, we don't concede that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Judge Jacobs, I just wanted to address the point about the subrogation agreement that you had raised. I think it's important to realize kind of the ordering of facts. At the time that the proof of claim was filed, Sumac was the creditor. Sinosure was not yet subrogated into Sumac's position. The proof of claim was filed on April 16, 2019. That's at Appendix 144. The subrogation agreement wasn't yet signed. It was signed in October 18, 2019, 6 months later. So at the time the proof of claim was filed, B&J was acting on behalf of the principal at that time, which was still Sumac. Though we think that the subrogation agreement is a side issue to this appeal, because as we had stated in our papers, the litigation administrator had no idea that the subrogation agreement even existed until way after service of process had already been effectuated. And so at the very minimum, B&J had apparent authority to act on behalf of the creditor that was listed in the proof of claim. And that apparent agency was not destroyed at the time service of process was effectuated. Now, Judge Lohier, I wanted to rebut your point about willfulness. As I was trying to do before in my opening remarks, the GU declaration that my colleague referred to, it never says the basic point. We had no idea about the adversary proceeding. It has a very artful language to try to mask that point. And as we say, they could have said whatever they wanted, and they don't say that very basic point. Another element to vacate the default judgment is that they had to show complete defenses to our claims. That's in Bricklayers, and that's also in McNulty, SEC v. McNulty. And we raised that point.
The absence of willfulness is enough, though, right, to vacate a default judgment?
Absolutely.
And that seems to me to be a finding by the district court. It's a little difficult for us to dislodge it, but you've made your arguments.
But the district court, Your Honor, is an appellate court. And
I understand it, but it's not really in a position to find, but know, it's, I have a hard time, maybe for the reasons mentioned by your friend, Mr. Rosner, seeing how this is a willful violation of anything.
Right, but they have to establish all three elements in order to vacate. And so even if you find that there is no willfulness, they still have to show meritorious defenses. You can't vacate a judgment if there are no meritorious.
Maybe I misunderstood. All right. Thank you very much.
Without that.
Thank you very much.
Thank
we'll reserve decision. And that concludes today.